There were a lot of crates and boxes to rummage through, too many to fit into even the monster's house-sized storage. It therefore had had to decide on the shiniest bits to bring along, which was what had taken most of the time. In the end, Boxy had decided to load up on all the decent arms and armor that it could find. The intel Zira had gotten from the dwarf called Tubbs had indicated that they could be sold for a good price across the border, unlike the shipments of illicit narcotics. The shapeshifter had taken 2 crates worth of honeydew-filled glass jars, however. Not because it wanted to sell or eat them, but simply because they were shiny. The thick liquid had a radiant golden color that glittered dazzlingly when bathed in light, so the creature had happily added the 4 dozen jars to its ever-expanding collection. It had still had some room left in its storage, so it had taken the opportunity to raid the cartel's food supplies. Most of them had been eaten, with the rest stored for later. Dried meats, grain crackers, and preserved fruits weren't all that tasty, but they were more than capable of sating its hunger. Not to mention that, if the shapeshifter wanted to disguise itself as a person, it would need to get used to eating the same foods that they did. Boxy had also made a point of taking 6 kegs of ale in accordance with Fizzy's input. According to her, the alchemically brewed dwarven beer was so valuable that it wasn't an exaggeration to call it liquid gold. A purely metaphorical statement, of course, as honeydew was significantly closer to the literal interpretation of that shiny-sounding comparison. And now that the looting was over, the shapeshifter looked hopefully up at the night sky, but wasn't particularly surprised to see that there weren't enough moons. Boxy had asked around and discovered that all 3 of the giant glowing things would only appear simultaneously once every few months. The event, known as the Lunar Convergence, would last for only about 5 or 6 hours at most, and its next occurrence would take place in about a month. It looked as though Boxy would be unable to attempt the unholy wealth ritual for quite some time, which was disappointing. Gathering and preparing all the necessary components and tools for the ritual in order to perform the ceremony at a moment's notice had ultimately been pointless. At the very least, the ritual required a material sacrifice rather than a living one, so it wouldn't have to concern itself with live captives when the time came. That thought was for later, however, as tonight it would be performing the offering to Leosolra. The ceremony, much like the offering to Nagnamor, would allow 1 of the 4 demonic overlords to manifest in the physical realm, albeit only for a few minutes. It wanted to do it right on the edge of a populated settlement as, prior to its capture, it had deduced that in order to raise its demonology skill level, it needed to do more than simply perform the rituals. It had to utilize them fully, which in the context of the offerings meant forcing, persuading, or otherwise goading the overlord into doing what the warlock wanted. So long as that included something more impactful than simply demanding that the demon punch themselves in the face over and over again. In other words, as long as it could coerce Leosolra into running wild through the town, it was sure to gain a significant amount of demonology proficiency. Of course, it also had to make sure that it wouldn't be stomped flat by an irate overlord, which was why the rooftop would serve as the ideal ritual site. Not only was it flat and large enough to house the demonic markings, but it also meant that Boxy would be able to make a run for it by jumping off and using the buildings for cover. That and summoning an overlord underground seemed awfully counterproductive when the goal was for the demon to rampage through the town. Come to think of it, would Leosolra even be like that? True, Punchy had tried to squash the little box into goop almost immediately, but that could have been because he was the most powerful archfiend in the beyond. That alone was enough to make him the avatar of irritability, aggression, and violence. It was unlikely that all the overlords were so destructive, right? Actually, if it wanted insider information on the inner workings of the Beyond's hierarchy, didn't it already have not 1, but 2 familiars that it could ask? With that in mind, Boxy turned to face its minions, who had followed it onto the roof.
"What's Leosolra actually like?"
it asked curiously. Cora, who was carrying a bound and gagged dwarf under 3 of her 4 arms, shrugged in ignorance.
"Dunno. I've heard of the name, but nothing about what they're like."
"How can you not know about Leosolra?"
Zira asked incredulously.
"Did you have your head up your ass the whole time you were in the Beyond?
Funny thing about that, actually.
It was a rhetorical question, you idiot.
The succubus interrupted, shaking her head.
I don't actually want to know.
Snack, do you know this guy?
Not personally, Master, but I have heard of her. Leosolra is the eldest of the overlords and the most reclusive. Very few demons have actually spoken to her, even among her peers or kin.
And what type of demon is she?
I don't know her exact species, but she's said to be the first stalker.
Oh, one of those, huh?
Stalkers were an arachnid species of anti-magic specialists. The lore gleaned from demonology had informed Boxy that they were cold and calculating, wanting nothing more than to devour anything in their path for their own enjoyment. They also enjoyed skulking around dark places and didn't appreciate being seen. So it made sense that Leosolra would live a hermit-like existence despite her station.
Think I can reason with her?
Boxy moved on to the meat of the matter.
I would advise against it, Master.
Zira shook her head.
Her kin can be just as violent and selfish as any other demon.
I see. So, summon and run would be best, huh?
Indeed.
What are you two nodding about over there?
Fizzy broke in. Not being privy to their telepathic communications, she had been left ignorant of the somewhat ominous conversation that had just transpired.
Nothing important.
Boxy shook its head.
Just be sure that the prisoners don't die until I need to sacrifice them.
The only conscious dwarf groaned and began to struggle against his bindings.
Yo! Titty McTitface!
The fiend raised her voice.
One of these guys woke up!
The succubus calmly turned around and placed a hand on the unfortunate dwarf's cheek, knocking him out with her sleep spell. Pacifying them wasn't to prevent their escape, as they certainly weren't strong enough to escape both their bindings and Cora's grip. However, it was possible that they would hurt themselves in their confusion or do something unhelpful like biting out their own tongues if they realized what Boxy had in store for them. Zira couldn't allow them to throw their lives away like that. Not when her master had a better use for them.
By the way, boss, why don't you just make an appo?
Cora suggested.
A what?
An appointment! For a summoning!
You can do that?
Zira asked in confusion.
Now who has her head up her ass?
Cora sneered.
That's how things are normally done, aren't they? You know, I heard the main reason Uncle Naggy was so mad that one time was because you pulled him away from the biannual five-dimensional tic-tac-toe tournament. Probably would have gone down better if you'd scheduled it beforehand.
Wait, isn't that the one Queen Shridiafriel managed to win a while back?
Shridiafriel, the most powerful among the succubus-type demons as well as their self-proclaimed queen, was also one of the four demonic overlords. Boxy recognized the name, as the offering to Shridiafriel was also one of the rituals it was aware of, but it had no intention whatsoever of performing that particular ceremony. A massive orgy demanding a literal cartload of semen to be prepared in advance was just too much work when compared to any of the others.
That's the one!
Cora nodded.
Losing to the queen bitch herself was bad enough, but I'm told the way she won't stop bragging about it is the worst part. As if finally breaking Uncle Naggy's streak of 362 consecutive victories by winning on a fucking technicality is something to be proud of.
The two overlords apparently had some sort of rivalry going on, and although Boxy had no idea what five-dimensional tic-tac-toe was, the name alone sounded much too complicated for its mortal mind to comprehend. The fact that Punchy was good enough to beat the ultimate succubus in a battle of wits was quite impressive. But then, his performance always had been top of the line. Plus, this provided some rather interesting insight into the inner workings of the Beyond. It made sense that Nagnamor would be pissed if he'd been pulled away from something fun. Then again, he'd probably rampage all on his own regardless of when, where, or by whom he was summoned, so Boxy didn't particularly feel like fretting over it.
How do I make an appointment? It asked.
Good question.
Cora furrowed her brow and thought.
I only heard about it from one of my brothers, so I don't know how it actually works. Why not give Carl a call? Have him figure it out.
Oh, great idea, Arms.
Now those were three words that Zira had never expected to hear in the same sentence. Then again, the two simpletons always seemed to be on a similar wavelength. One of violence, instant gratification, and not thinking things through properly. But similar nonetheless.
Okay, I'll be busy talking to Carl, so don't bother me unless it's an emergency,
Boxy said out loud for Fizzy's benefit.
Keep watch on those three, especially the one on the left. He's awake and pretending to be asleep.
Its minions kept a watchful eye on the prisoners as Boxy mind-dialed Demons R Us. 1-800-735-5-9687-7685.
Hello, you've reached Demons R Us. My name is Carl, and I'll be... Oh, hey, Boxy!
You knew it was me?
Yeah, I asked the boss to install caller ID so that I know when it's you on the line.
What's a caller ID? Is it tasty?
Kind of, yeah,
Carl responded, having grown fairly fluent in Mimikinese as of late.
So, what can I help you with today, buddy?
I want to make an appointment.
What? What are you talking about?
I'm about to summon an unbound demon with a ritual. Arm said that appointments could be made ahead of time.
Oh, right, those, of course. Sorry about that. It was an unusual request, so it caught me a bit off guard.
Really? Arm said that this was normal.
Well, normal isn't the word I'd use. It's proper procedure, yes, but it's hardly common practice. Mortals rarely call us to ask about anything other than their contracts, you see. We don't even hear from most after their first familiar's been bound to them, either because they're lazy or seem to think that we'll suck their soul out through the connection or something.
Can you actually do that?
We wouldn't have a lot of clients if we did, you know.
I see.
It made sense in a way. Not only would dead warlocks make for poor customers, but nobody would be willing to work with Demons R Us if they gained a reputation for doing that. Boxy didn't fail to notice, however, that Carl had evaded the question of whether he could do that, but decided not to press the issue.
Alrighty then. Who is it you want to make an appointment with?
The devil asked matter-of-factly.
Leas Alra.
Oh, another overlord, huh? And how will you be performing the summoning?
Boxy briefly pondered the question. Were there other ways to call forth the demonic overlords? That did seem to be the case, now that it thought back to the deal it had made to never summon Punchy again.
I'll be doing the offering.
You're not using your familiars as collateral, right?
Carl asked sternly.
No.
Okay, good. Just checking to make sure you didn't forget... And when will you be planning on performing this offering?
As soon as possible.
The short notice might be a problem. Hold on, let me check her schedule real quick. Ah, you're in luck. Overlord Leosora is available for the next 6 hours. If you miss that window, then the next opening is 4 days from now.
What is it that you guys actually do over there?
Boxy couldn't help but notice that these overlords sounded surprisingly busy considering that they spent every waking moment inside a realm of thoughts and dreams. It had been under the impression that demons were perpetually bored and mostly just lazed around telling stories when they were in the beyond.
Afraid I can't tell you,
answered Carl.
It's classified. Plus, you seem like you wouldn't understand even if I told you.
Yeah, probably not, it agreed.
The shapeshifter was still having trouble grasping concepts through words alone, though it was good at learning by watching and doing. That was why it had needed so much hands-on practice with its infiltration skills in the first place.
So then, you said you wanted to perform the ritual right away?
Yes.
Okay, you're all set. Just have to wait for her or her assistant to respond to the D-mail I sent and... Oh, never mind! She's already agreed to the summoning. You have a knack for getting instant replies to stuff, don't you?
That was it. It seemed almost too easy.
So, I can just carry on with the ritual?
Sure, go right ahead.
She won't try to eat me when she comes out, right?
That is something I do not know. Nor would I be at liberty to say, even if I did. The only thing I can state for certain is that she's expecting you to summon her.
Along with the unspoken addendum that if Boxy valued its existence, it would not keep the Overlord waiting.
I see. Thanks, Carl.
Anytime, buddy. Will that be all for today?
Yes.
All right, then. I'm looking forward to seeing how this one turns out. Bye-bye!
Wait, what did... Oh.
Carl had hung up before Boxy could ask what he had meant by that last comment. Come to think of it, he had mentioned something about observing the creature the last time they had spoken to. Perhaps Demons R Us was keeping an eye on it to ensure that it didn't violate its amended contract? That certainly seemed plausible, though Boxy somehow felt that that wasn't the case. For the moment, though, it seemed to have a good working relationship with Demons R Us, so it didn't worry too much as it began its preparations. Boxy opened its storage, bringing out everything necessary for the ritual. A wooden bucket, a wide painter's brush, 4 vials of blue-tinted mana potion, and a bottle of clear alcohol called vodka. That last hadn't been looted from the cartel's pantry, but swiped from the restaurant the organization had used as a front. Boxy had little interest in alcohol as it found the taste rather disgusting, but it wasn't planning to drink the bottle anyway. The ritual didn't call for vodka specifically, but a clear and hefty bottle of spirits. This stuff just happened to fit the bill. It poured the vodka and mana potions into the bucket, then used the brush to stir them together. It then held its human-looking hand over the substance, morphed one of its fingers into a razor, and slit its wrist open. The ritual demanded the lifeblood of the summoner, so it allowed the blood to spill in thick globs into the mixture below. Unlike the viscous yellow blood of a mimic, however, this stuff was dark red, bordering on black. The shapeshifter found that it could dilute the blood to look more like that of real people, but this was how doppelganger blood looked in its natural form. Once Boxy was sure the mixture was equal parts alcohol, blood, and mana potion, it reactivated its mend flesh skill to replenish its vitality and continued stirring. The various fluids formed some sort of alchemical reaction, the mixture adopting a rich purple color and becoming rather sticky and goopy in consistency. With the paint now ready, Boxy set about preparing the actual ritual site. First, it made a large circle about 5 meters in diameter, then drew an equal-sided triangle inside with each point touching the edge of the circle. It added another circle inside the triangle, making sure that the edges touched each of the triangle's 3 sides. Satisfied with the concentric geometric shapes, it proceeded to draw 3 complicated demonic sigils in the spaces between the triangle and the outer circle. Boxy wondered why this ritual was so much more complicated than the previous one had been, but it made sense if this Leosolra really was the eldest of the overlords. Not to mention that it expected her to have a much more reasonable personality than that living mass of flames and hate, though that could be said of just about anyone. After finishing the sigils, it ordered Cora to place the sleeping dwarves inside the circle, warning her to be extra careful not to step on the still wet markings. She placed a sacrifice in each space between the triangle and the inner circle. Their unconscious bodies were made to sit upright, although their upper bodies naturally lurched forward. It was an awkward posture, but it was good enough so long as their heads were within arm's reach of the middle of the formation. A precaution that the shapeshifter immediately realized was moot, considering that it could easily extend its limbs should need be. Making sure everything was in order, Boxy thought back to what it had learned regarding Leosolra's race. Some subspecies of stalkers were rumored to quite literally feast on mana, so there was a chance that she might try to suck the magic from any powerful enchanted gear she came across. The creature naturally wanted to avoid losing the things that it had gained from its most recent dungeon expedition, so it took measures to safeguard its belongings. A private pocket dimension seemed like a good enough hiding spot, so it opened its storage to stow Voidcaller inside for safekeeping. It then removed a few sets of armor in order to make room for Fizzy. While the left hand of the Forsaken Sentinel was technically part of her body, it was still an artifact-grade magic item, and as such might tickle Leosolra's fancy. And since it couldn't be removed, that meant that the golem herself had to go inside its storage, much to her disappointment. She was loath to return to the claustrophobic space, plus she was curious as to what the actual ritual would look like. Still, Spending some time in boxy storage was infinitely preferable to having her left arm eaten, so she begrudgingly crawled inside the swirling portal. Its preparations complete, the elf-shaped monster stood in the center of the formation, gripping an iron dagger in each hand. It cleared its throat as it got ready to perform the actual ceremony. It rested its arms against its sides and reversed the grip on its weapons so that they were pointing backwards, then began to bounce lightly in place using only its ankles and knees, causing its entire body to move up and down to some unheard rhythm. Once it was moving at about 2 or 3 bounces per second, it began to shake its hips in an exaggerated manner. They swayed left and right in time with its bounces, much to Cora's amusement. Boxy lifted its arms over its head, pressing the hilts of its daggers against the top of its skull so that the blades pointed upwards. It twisted its wrists slightly to tilt the weapons forward and back, like sharp rabbit ears that bobbed and swayed in time with its movements. The shapeshifter opened its mouth and began to chant.
Morbia lequet you dolora met, nulla actore ni non fonset, roncasel, porta scora foralet.
The strange words took on an oddly melodic tone, almost like singing. A strangely upbeat and energetic song, too, entirely mismatched with its grim purpose.
Nectum felis magna, wa-a-a, o vica era helftum, la-la-la, yo sol mi, til de la melody.
Crouching smoothly, Boxy leaned forward and stretched its arms out. Its iron daggers easily pierced the top of the first dwarf's skull, relieving him of his life in an instant. The weapons were immediately withdrawn as the shapeshifter elf spun with a little pirouette, turning to face the sigil opposite the first sacrifice before resuming its bounce-assisted hip-swaying.
Dan salmelaus, clapper in a handan, your son leors, tura sindel dance, dan mis laulai, misa in da clansan, lignari haradi caramel tansan.
The purplish paint on the ground pulsed with a soft pink light that flashed for a split second every time Boxy finished a downward motion. A strange mist gathered over the arcane sigil, the intensifying flashes from below casting a vaguely humanoid shadow within the off-white vapor cloud.
Det blir insensation verfältstas, vister kommer alla slipalas, kom igen, nu tar vi stegen om igen.
A steady thumping noise came from below, as if accompanying the strange song and dance. The figure in the mist became more and more defined into a solid, feminine shape, which mirrored the creature's bizarre movements.
Nectum felis magna, wa-a-a, o vica era helftum, la-la-la, yo sol mi, til de la melody.
Boxy repeated the second verse, spinning to pierce the second dwarf's skull. It pirouetted once again, turning to face the next sigil.
Dan salmelaus, clapper in a handan, yours and leors, tura sindel dansan, mis laulai, misa in da clansan, lignari haradi caramel tansan.
The odd mist had by now spread over the entire rooftop, obscuring the view of the town around it. A second feminine figure appeared, also mimicking the shapeshifter's movements. Lights went on in multiple houses as the locals finally began to notice the ritual taking place. Fearing that the guards might try to intervene, Boxy gave a curt mental order to Arms and Snack to block the stairs to buy it time.
Curabitur matis diam erutram, quis gabil in vestibulam, yo portas, nulla viteo fletas.
Its voice had been steadily rising in pitch the whole time, and by now it sounded like something one would expect to hear out of a chipmunk. The strange colors flashing within the fog became brighter and more varied as it continued.
Nectum felis magna, wa-a-a, o vica era helftum, la-la-la, yo sol mi, til de la melody.
The third and last dwarf's life was severed fluidly as Boxy turned to the final sigil.
Dan salmelaus, clapper in a handan, yours and leors, tura sindel dansan, mis laulai, misa in da clansan, lignari haradi caramel tansan.
There were now 3 shadowy backup dancers performing the otherworldly song and dance. Boxy moved relentlessly, shouting,
ooh, 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 ah, ooh, ah,
every now and then. Sounds of combat erupted from below as its familiars engaged the boot-split guards. People on the surrounding rooftops fired arrows and magic into the dense fog, but they couldn't even see what they were aiming at, and the projectiles were swallowed by the glowing miasma surrounding the warlock. The mimic refused to allow any of this to distract it and kept performing its part resolutely as the noise intensified. The 3 corpses deteriorated rapidly until all that was left of them were bleached bones, at which point both the thumping and the light show suddenly subsided. Boxy took its cue, standing perfectly still with the blood-soaked daggers crossed in front of its face. However, judging by the shadowy dancers continuing to bounce, the ritual wasn't over quite yet.
Sed honore dolor erat. Quis placerat ega dignissimet.
Its voice rose to the heavens as its MP began to decrease. The simple daggers glowed a blindingly bright blue, the color spreading through the mist like ink through water. The town's defenders had managed to fight through its familiars in the meantime, forcing them to fall back to the roof as they stalled for time. The mortals would follow after them any second now, but they would be too late to stop what was about to happen. Boxy shouted the final part of the incantation, flinging the daggers upward with all its might. They exploded in a blinding flash of light with a noise like a thunderclap. Wasting no time, Boxy leapt off the side of the building, landing on the cobblestone street. It attempted to execute a forward roll to redirect its momentum, but slipped on the wet ice that had begun to melt in the morning sun and fell flat on its back.
Wait. What?
The confused doppelganger looked around in a panic, noticing that it was now apparently morning and the street, along with the surrounding townscape, had been entombed in clear blue ice, its robes encrusted with the large, jagged shards. It checked on its status, noticing immediately that its demonology skill had gone up to level 7. The final, though hardly most bizarre change that it noticed was that it had been stabbed through the chest with a large, sword-shaped icicle. The ice had pinned a piece of strange, snow-white parchment with some writing on it to Boxy's person. The monster unhesitatingly pulled the sharp object from its chest to grab hold of the cloth. Or at least it tried, but the parchment was frustratingly hard to grasp. It was like a piece of silk so smooth that it seemed unaffected by something as basic as friction. The doppelganger would not be bested by a piece of cloth, however, and it gripped the offending parchment by puncturing its edges with a set of needle-like steel claws. Now that the notice was firmly in hand, it took a long, hard look, failing to read a single word of it. It tried ordering its familiars to its side, but they had apparently been killed during whatever it was that had happened last night. Boxy suddenly realized that it had an able reader almost literally right under its nose and opened its storage so that Fizzy could finally crawl out.
Finally!
She exclaimed.
I was stuck in there for... What? Huh?
Her words trailed off into confusion as she beheld the Winter Wonderland.
Read this!
Boxy thrust the parchment into her face as it spoke, obscuring the surreal scenery. Fizzy, whose thought processes were currently busy, well, processing, ground to a halt upon seeing the contents of the note. She knew many things, but how to respond to this was not one of them. Dear Boxy, sorry for freezing you like that. I'm a bit shy, you see, so I didn't feel comfortable having you stare at me while I did my thing. I appreciated the chance to come out and play, though. It was a lot of fun, heart, heart, heart. Call on me again if you need something else put on ice. We'll hang, okay? XOXOXO, Leosolra of the Endless Swarm. Epilogue. Spymaster Edward Allen walked briskly along the cobblestone road, careful to be mindful of his footing. He wore a thick brown cloak which hid his entire body from view, with his official officer's uniform underneath. The dark gray leather armor and pale blue tabard denoted his imperial status, but could not shield him from the cold. As odd as it was to be worried about such things during the last days of summer, the current environment nevertheless demanded it. The similarly clothed figure to his right was the black-haired beauty with the call sign, Zone. She kept a silent vigil on their frozen surroundings, her face so utterly devoid of emotion that it fit right in with the frigid weather and silent streets. Though they were walking through the middle of Bootsplit, a once lively dwarven town along the Imperial Highway, their surroundings were completely devoid of life. The road the officers were walking on, along with most of the neighborhood, had been encased in a thick layer of ice quite literally overnight. Nearly 1,000 of the town's residents had been caught in the inexplicable and clearly unnatural event, and several adventurer guilds outside the disaster area had also been turned into glaciers. The fact that those offices had apparently been specifically targeted was a clear sign that the tragedy was no accident or random quirk of nature, but a calculated, deliberate act of terrorism. One that had somehow been carried out without leaving a single witness capable of explaining what, exactly, had transpired here. Which was why Edward and his team had been dispatched to investigate. The spymaster himself hadn't particularly seen the need to come out here himself, but a direct order from the Emperor wasn't something that he could just ignore. And now that he was actually here, he felt an odd tingle of foreboding. It was the same sensation that he had experienced when he had first laid eyes on the smoldering crater and perpetual dust storm that had once been the city of Monatol. For this place was still frozen solid, despite the event having taken place 6 days ago. The unnatural ice permeating the entire town seemed to melt somewhat during the day, but grew thick and heavy once more as soon as the sun went down. While the Arcanium dispatch that had come along with the spymaster had been steadily working to thaw the place with magic, it would probably take them weeks before they finished. Even then, the damage had already been done. The memory of the disaster would linger forever, a black mark in the Empire's history books. Again, much like Monatol. Edward and Zone continued to pick their way along the ice-covered ground until they made it to their destination, the local branch of the Order of the Black Wand. The Arcanium boys had already liberated the building from the persistent ice and were using it as a temporary headquarters. The armed guards at the front door saluted silently as the officers entered the water-damaged remnants of the guild's waiting area. Several people in various robes were milling about, as well as a few civilians who had either been brought in for questioning or had only just now been thawed from their icy cocoons.
"Hey, old man! How's it hanging?"
A cheerful voice, completely ill-befitting the solemn atmosphere, called out to Edward. The spymaster scowled, turning to face the one who had addressed him so brazenly. The man's short blonde hair glistened with moisture, though whether it was sweat or water was difficult to tell. His blue eyes were barely visible through his squinting eyelids, the youthful, clean-shaven face set in a thoroughly carefree smile. He wore a set of light blue robes draped with a pale blue officer's tabard, a patch emblazoned with the gilded hand's insignia stitched to his left shoulder.
"How many times do I have to tell you not to address me so casually?"
Edward chastised him.
"Sorry, old ma- I mean, sir? Force of habit."
"Drop the antics question. Show me what you found."
"Ah, right. Walk this way."
Edward and Zone followed the man known as Question into the back of the building and up to the second floor. They went into a conference room filled with a massive table and a number of chairs, although it appeared that it was currently in use as an office of some sort. Stacks of paper were strewn about the table and all over the floor, while a huge map of the surrounding area had been pinned to one of the walls. Question spent a minute moving the mess around to allow his compatriots to take a seat, then stood next to the map. He picked up a wooden pointer from the floor, slamming it against the map with a flourish.
"Right, so,"
he began his presentation,
"the good news is, I believe we've identified the root cause of what we're tentatively calling F-Day. The bad news is that it's your fault, old man."
Edward sighed in exasperation.
"For the 100th time, Question, not every single bad thing that happens is my fault."
He would have already slapped the upstart into next week if he hadn't been aware of his problematic personality. It wasn't just him, either. Some way or another, every single person within his inner circle had some troublesome quirk to them. Edward couldn't help but wonder, yet again, how had it gotten like this?
"No, of course not!"
Question chuckled, tapping the map again.
"This one is, though. Look, I even made you a diagram."
He reached into his robe, pulling out a slightly wrinkled piece of parchment. He unrolled it to reveal a number of graphs and pie charts which he had neatly drawn up, along with the words, "Conclusion, Edward's fault," circled and underlined in the corner.
"The facts don't lie, you know,"
he added with a carefree smile. Edward sighed again. He may have been insufferable, but if there was one thing Question was good at, it was finding answers. The man's skill at gathering, organizing, and analyzing information was top-notch, not to mention his extraordinary ability to spot patterns. The problem was that, although those qualities made him good at piecing together puzzles, they also made him an intolerable know-it-all. Not to mention that he always found a way to blame Edward for every single bad thing that he had ever been asked to investigate. His determination to lay blame upon his employer would have been impressive if it hadn't been so damned infuriating. Still, if Question had any insight into the mystery at hand, then it was Edward's duty as his superior to hear him out. It was the only reason that the spymaster was willing to tolerate the analyst's borderline insubordination in the first place.
All right, let's hear it, he said dejectedly. Show me what you got.
Do you want the short version or the long version? The blonde man asked, twirling his pointer.
Is the short version, this whole boot split incident is Edward's fault?
Maybe.
Then give me the long version.
Gladly.
Question smiled widely as he started his explanation.
So, let's begin by establishing the ways in which Edward failed to prevent this catastrophe. First of all, you let your mimic prisoner escape.
Zone, who had fittingly been zoning out until then, suddenly took notice, as she had a personal stake in the prisoner that had gotten away. Her mentor, on the other hand, was much less enthusiastic, judging by the way he furrowed his brow and pinched the bridge of his nose irritably.
So that thing's involved after all, huh?
The incident already had the same stench to it as the Monotol case, so it wasn't as though part of him hadn't been expecting this. Boxy T. Morningwood had proven far more annoying than the spymaster had initially anticipated. First had come the inane answers that had somehow managed to confuse even his eyes of truth during the interrogation. Then it had somehow managed to escape its bindings mid-flight, which, while impressive in its own way, had drastically derailed the spymaster's plans to replicate the calamity. The bright side, though, was that it had at least dropped a few hints as to where Edward could start looking. Based on the new information, the spymaster had sent Zone with a few other subordinates and some scholars on an expedition to Red Rock Ravine, a weak, out-of-the-way dungeon on the Empire's eastern fringe. Their task had been to extract the dungeon core and discover how to force it to go into meltdown. And while conquering the ravine and locating the core had both been accomplished easily thanks to Zone's absurd strength, the team's efforts had thereby immediately ground to a halt. They were completely unable to dislodge the dungeon core from its magically affixed spot. They had arrived at the site with various theories and guesses, yet hadn't managed to make any progress even after weeks of poking and prodding at the crystal sphere. The Empire's foremost experts on dungeons, and they'd been losing to a 2-month-old monster that didn't even know how to tie its metaphorical shoelaces. Not a single one of them had been able to figure out how to make the blasted core move even a single millimeter from its original position. Well, that wasn't entirely true. Zone had proposed hitting it really hard, which had been immediately shot down by every scholar at the site. They had been adamant that there was simply no way for brute force to overcome a dungeon's peculiar brand of magic when their own spells, potions, and magic tools had failed. The most her idea would accomplish, they claimed, was to damage or even rupture the dungeon core, possibly causing it to explode right on the spot. Zone had merely shrugged and continued to follow her orders to keep them out of danger. Her instructions had been to keep them safe, not assist with the actual experiments, so she had quietly fulfilled her duties without sticking her neck out until she'd finally been relieved by someone else 2 weeks ago. And judging from her mentor's perpetually bad mood, those self-proclaimed experts hadn't made a single shred of progress since. In the end, Edward had been left without the weapon of mass destruction that he had wanted so badly, at least until he could recapture Boxy and properly interrogate it. That, however, was easier said than done. The possible places that the monster could have hidden were just too numerous to launch any sort of coordinated search. Its name had, of course, been added to the country's list of wanted criminals, but that would only pan out if it were stupid enough to try to do mercenary guild work again. As for the gnome, Edward had already written her off when Hook's investigation of her psychic residue had revealed that she had undoubtedly been eaten. One less thing to worry about, at least, especially considering the very real possibility that the creature had had outside assistance during its escape. That was a separate mystery altogether, however, and there were more immediate concerns for Edward to deal with.
All right, Question. Let's hear it,
the spymaster said tiredly.
Hear what?
The analyst asked in mock ignorance.
You know damn well what I'm talking about. Just get it out of your system so we can move on with this.
Oh, do you mean the fact that I told you so? Because I did tell you that that monster was definitely going to come up north. But no, my baseless conjecture wasn't enough for you. You didn't want to waste precious manpower to search beyond the Sawblade Mountains and ignored your damned analyst. Because we were certain to figure out the Calamity Method all on our own. Well, guess what? We got done in by a fucking box. Not once, not twice, but three fucking times. All because you refused to listen to me, you senile old geezer.
Question took a few deep breaths to calm himself down. He had gotten so engrossed in his rant that he actually felt a bit dizzy.
Are you done?
Edward asked.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm done.
Good.
Question regained consciousness a few minutes later and continued his presentation as though nothing had happened. Zone made a mental note of the blonde analyst's grit and dedication. It took a special kind of fortitude to speak so calmly after being literally kicked through the wall. That said, she was having an awfully hard time taking him seriously with Edward's boot print on his face. That would stick around for at least a few days, if past experience was any indication.
So, once the mimic escaped from the Griffins, it landed somewhere in the Sawblade Mountains.
He traced Boxy's route across the map as he spoke.
It then moved steadily northwards, avoiding civilization for the most part. Given Zone's appraisal of the creature and the average level of monsters in that region, it's highly likely that it is already ranked up.
Shit.
Edward cursed under his breath, though not because he disagreed with Question's words. Quite the opposite, in fact. It was only natural that a creature capable of wiping out entire squads of armed guards would have little difficulty battling its fellow monsters, and the wilderness held no shortage of targets. Tracking the thing had been difficult enough when it had been just a box-bound shapeshifter, and now it had probably evolved into something else entirely. With no way of knowing what species it had ranked up to, his agents would have no idea what they were even looking for anymore.
We then received some information regarding the mountain village of Karan south of here,
Question continued.
A merchant reported it as completely deserted with not a single soul in sight. After sending people to investigate, we've been able to determine that the village was not abandoned, but eaten.
The spymaster blinked.
Come again? A whole village was eaten?
Indeed. There were no signs of open combat and no bodies to be found, just empty houses and bloodied bedrooms, except for what appeared to be the guards or militia protecting the wall. Those had been turned into piles of black ash.
I see. That's definitely our monster's handiwork.
Boxy had left behind a similar trail at the site of a certain caravan that it had ambushed on its way from Monotol to Erosa. Unfortunately, neither Question nor those Arcanium eggheads had been able to figure out exactly what could have produced those peculiar leftovers, but they were nonetheless a dead giveaway that Boxy had been there.
How many casualties?
285. Well, assumed anyway. Couldn't confirm the exact count, but given the circumstances...
So it must have spent several days feasting on them?
Indeed. Though it likely eliminated all the civilians on day one, I find it impossible to believe that a single monster could consume so much mass in one sitting. That said, there was nothing stopping it from loading the bodies onto a cart or something and taking them with it.
A reasonable assumption, though it severely underestimated Boxy's post-rank-up hunger pangs.
Whatever the case, it must have known we'd be coming after it,
the spymaster mumbled, mostly to himself.
It wouldn't have stayed long before moving on, and given its path, it must have passed through here.
Yup,
Question confirmed.
And that's when it somehow caused F-Day, huh?
Nope.
What do you mean, nope? This sort of disaster is clearly right up its alley.
That may be so,
and while the mimic was likely involved, I have reason to believe the chief perpetrator in this case was someone else. Here, give me a sec. The analyst stepped away from the map for a moment to rummage through his notes. He brought out a large rolled parchment, which he unfurled and stuck roughly to the wall with a couple of small knives. Generally speaking, pinning things to the walls in a borrowed space was quite rude, not to mention unnecessary. However, Edward had already put a question-shaped hole in the wall, so nobody was going to notice a few knife marks. Besides, the gilded hand was hardly one to hesitate when it came to property damage.
Now then, where were we?
He tapped his pointer on the new map, this one of the Empire's northern territory. As he spoke, he indicated the Empire's capital city at the southern edge of the paper.
I spoke briefly with Master Shinji in Oshinus, just before we were dispatched here.
Your old teacher, right?
The name rang a bell in Edward's mind. The two of them had met only in passing, but the spymaster still knew of Arakawa Shinji, the level 100 warlock who lived in the northern province not far from the town of Bootsplit. He was an odd man with a dubious background, but his loyalty and service to the Empire were exemplary. Although not quite a full-blown meritocracy, the Lodrak Empire had a long-standing tradition of uplifting those who had proved themselves capable. Shinji was one such, as his position of Viscount had been earned through his blood, sweat, and tears, rather than simply handed to him due to noble birthright.
Is he involved in this somehow?
Not that I know of,
Question shook his head.
Though the old geezer did tell me something interesting. Apparently, he encountered the most intriguing ginger-haired elf on his way to the capital. Shinji's a bit of a misanthrope, so the fact that he took notice of a stranger struck me as unusual. Although he admitted that the elf himself looked pretty plain, apparently his entourage was anything but. He was accompanied by a steel golem and two demons that appeared to be his familiars, namely a blue-skinned succubus and a female fiend, both with exceptionally huge knockers.
Edward cupped his chin and thought.
Sounds like their owner is quite the...
He froze mid-sentence as a crazy idea struck him. He pulled out his booklet, leafing through until he reached his notes on a certain interview from over a month ago. He quickly skimmed the page with the words, "perverted box," circled and underlined at the top.
The elf was our mimic?
He exclaimed.
Close, old-timer, but not quite. He is, however, our main suspect.
Question pointed back to the map of Bootsplit, more specifically its southern gate, his expression turning uncharacteristically serious.
An elf whose description matched the one Master Shinji gave me was recorded entering the town the day after their chance meeting took place, on the morning before F-Day. The scribe on duty logged him as a 17-year-old male elf, a level 25 warlock bearing the name Chester Underwood.
Edward nearly leapt from his seat at the last bit.
An Underwood was here?
Coming from a long line of spies, assassins, and sleeper agents with strong ties to the Ishigar Republic's Foreign Intelligence Bureau, the elves of the Underwood family were notorious within the world of international espionage. They had a reputation for being meticulous, efficient, and highly adaptive, one that Edward had been able to personally confirm during his many years of service to the Emperor. Just thinking about those people made the deep scars on his left cheek and forehead ache. That said, something seemed off about this.
Are we certain it was the real deal? Those twigs would never leave an obvious trail like this.
Indeed, in most cases one would never know an Underwood was in their midst until well after they were gone. And that was assuming that anyone ever realized they had been there at all. While one would think an appraisal would be enough to root them out, these were agents with government connections. It was shockingly easy for them to have the names on their status discreetly altered by the right scribe. As a matter of fact, that had been one of Zone's main duties for years.
Normally, I would agree with your skepticism, Question
twirled his pointer.
However, I believe that this was a deliberate act rather than an oversight.
So, they wanted us to know that they've been through here.
Yup,
the younger man nodded.
To what purpose, though?
I'm getting to that.
Question rummaged again through the stacks of papers, pulling out one marked with the Order of the Black Wand's official stamp.
These here are the confidential results of the full appraisal of one Chester Underwood. He visited this guild in order to have his warlock job advanced and get a magic item appraised. His warlock skill set is, well, it's exactly the same as the ones the mimic had, based on Zone's report.
Edward took the documented appraisal results, mulling them over.
So he had the demonology skill. No mentor skill, so he wasn't the one who gave the monster its warlock job. Perhaps they had the same teacher? Wait, who was the trainer that this elf met with?
One Joshua Grimebeard. Missing, of course.
Missing? So, he's not one of the frozen dwarfsicles littered about the place?
The majority of the citizens of Bootsplit caught in the wake of the catastrophe had been encased in the same magical ice that had covered the entire neighborhood. It hadn't killed them outright, but had instead placed them in a sort of magically induced suspended animation. Not all had survived the process, and many were still being thought out, but Arcanium reports suggested that at least 60% of them were expected to make a full recovery. Frankly speaking, the fact that any of them were able to be saved was nothing short of miraculous.
We've had several subjects who match his physical appearance, but none who were affiliated with the Order, Question explained. His place of residence was outside of the affected area, so theoretically, he should have been spared. As far as we can tell, he gathered his valuables and skipped town in the confusion, though it's hard to tell if this happened before or after everything froze. But the timing is rather curious.
I see. It makes sense that he wouldn't want to stick around if he was involved. The fact that this Underwood went to see him specifically also concerns me. Their kind normally doesn't trust anyone outside of their own family.
It's not unreasonable to think that a dwarf could be an Underwood, Question pointed out. Unlikely, but not impossible.
Enlightened races could easily procreate with one another, after all. The resulting mixbloods would always be of the same species as the mother, though they would inherit certain traits from the father. One such example was sitting next to Edward, in fact, as Zone was the product of the extremely unlikely union between a human woman and a raptor male. Her yellow eyes and odd personality were things the spymaster attributed to her lizard man of a father.
I suppose the Underwoods are a fairly diverse clan, Edward conceded. Hold on a minute, though. How do we know this Chester fellow is connected to our mimic?
Suggesting that the name may be a pun on the word chest,
the female officer in the room spoke up.
Please don't insult my intelligence, Zone, Question shot her down. My conclusions are based on more than just word association, even if my evidence is somewhat circumstantial.
Ironically enough, though, the woman's blind guess had in fact been right on the money. The main reason Boxy had chosen Chester Underwood as its alias was due entirely to the fact that it saw itself as an undercover wooden chest.
Enlighten us, then, Edward insisted. What is this circumstantial evidence of yours?
The ledger at the South Gate said that our suspect wore a robe bearing the insignia of the Brotherhood of the Third Eye, a small-time caster-oriented guild, one with an office in Karan. Question thwacked the village's position on the map. Our suspect's physical appearance matched the recorded description of one of the guild's members, though the attached name was obviously something else. Based on that, and what Master Shinji told me of his random encounter, I have concluded that the elf was most likely an FIB agent using the village as a base of operations.
It was perhaps a bit ambitious to assume that a 17-year-old could be an agent or spy, but only if one underestimated the Underwoods. Subterfuge had run through the clan's veins since the days of the Elven Dominion, and they started training their field operatives at a young age, generally around 10 years old.
And you're sure he was working with our escaped mimic?
I honestly don't see how else the elf could have survived. A single warlock would be no match for a medium-sized monster with at least twice as many levels, especially if he was gutted in his sleep like the rest of the villagers seem to have been.
I see. It certainly sounds feasible when you put it like that.
The assumption was admittedly, as Question had stated, based on rather circumstantial evidence. Still, there were simply too many factors supporting the theory. Not to mention that this boxy tea Morningwood had proven itself capable of cooperating with enlightened individuals rather than simply killing them outright. The next question was, what sort of deal could possibly have been made that would be worth it to both sides? Unfortunately, the answer was painfully obvious.
Huh. Those FIB bastards got us good, didn't they?
Edward sighed with a small, dry chuckle. The elf must have promised the monster asylum across the border in exchange for information on the calamity. He would keep his life and bring his superiors a lovely present, while the mimic would in turn receive their protection. It was also likely that whoever had broken Boxy out of captivity had pointed it towards the youngster as a point of contact.
Oh? Could it be that this old geezer hasn't gone completely senile?
What about F-Day, though?
Edward ignored Question's comment.
How does that relate to any of this?
According to our investigation of the area, the epicenter of the ice is an establishment called the Cracked Flagon.
He pointed towards a particular spot on the town map, a small red X directly in the middle of a larger red circle, presumably the borders of the frozen disaster area.
That sounds familiar, Edward noted.
It should. It serves, well, served as a front for the Honeydew Cartel. You know, the one we occasionally hired to... I mean, the cartel that we have absolutely no connection to that sometimes came up in our reports since they smuggled weapons and drugs in and out of the Elven Republic?
Right, that ridiculous little outfit with the granny figurehead. What about them?
Well, their entire operation was dismantled, likely prior to the town being frozen solid. Their underground hideout was mostly untouched by the ice, so we were able to confirm the signs of an intense battle. Lots of property damage, smashed furniture, blood stains, etc., but not a single sign of a corpse aside from a dozen or so piles of black ash.
Meaning that our monster single-handedly wiped them out.
Exactly. The analyst nodded grimly. Also, judging from the evidence at the scene, it would appear that the fighting broke out around the innermost chamber, which was likely the boss's room.
So, the mimic didn't fight its way in, but started with the head. It's not a bad approach to dealing with punks like this. But why would it even bother?
Well, a large portion of their warehouses appeared to have been rummaged through and looted. We have no idea of what exactly was taken, but were able to confirm that a large number of weapons, armor, and provisions were missing.
Any signs of our elven warlock at the scene?
Indeed, on the rooftop of the Cracked Flagon.
The analyst circled the spot on the map with his pointer.
Not to mention traces of what Arcanium boys confirmed to be a warlock's shadow-attuned magic.
So, the elf in the box walked into the bar, trying to strike a deal that went bad and took the things they wanted with them.
It was a somewhat stereotypical scenario, but that was what made it so believable.
I'm lacking enough information to make a concrete call on that front, Question noted, but it seems likely, especially since our investigation of the warlock trainer suggested that he had dealings with them.
That Grimbeard fellow?
Grimebeard, but yes, him. He was probably the elf's in to the cartel.
I don't like this,
Edward grumbled, scowling.
Too many ifs, likelies, and probablies. This isn't like you, Question.
Hey, I'm not omniscient, the analyst shrugged. And at least I have the decency to admit it, unlike you, he added internally.
You're thinking something rude, aren't you?
The spymaster asked sourly.
No such thing, sir.
Edward didn't need a lie detector to tell him that Question was being dishonest, but the ultimate skill certainly helped.
What was that about the roof?
He asked, trying to get the meeting back on track.
Oh, right. We found this formation drawn on the rooftop. It was clearly visible under the ice, so our scouts were able to copy it easily enough.
He reached into his robes and brought out a small piece of paper, which he showed to Edward. On it was a diagram of a circle inside a triangle inside a second, bigger circle. Three strange symbols were scribbled in the gaps between the concentric shapes.
Arcanium confirmed that this was a formation for a demonic ritual linked with the demonology skill, Question explained. And judging from the entombed skeletal remains, they were able to complete it successfully. The ritual in question was identified as the offering to... Lusa...
He took a brief pause to double-check the name written next to the diagram.
Leosolra?
Zone chimed in.
Yeah, what she said.
The spymaster raised his eyebrows.
So there exist fools in this day and age who would perform one of those?
Edward was aware of these offerings since he had made a point of educating himself on such matters during his investigation of the Monotol incident. It hadn't taken long before he had concluded that the rituals were nothing more than a grandiose form of suicide. Summoning a big-shot demonic overlord sounded intriguing, but those beings' uncontrollable nature meant that their summoner would also definitely get caught up in the rampage. In the spymaster's opinion, anyone willing to sacrifice their fellow man solely to curry favor with a demon deserved everything that happened to them afterwards.
You're certain that this ritual was the cause of this F-Day?
That's right, Question confirmed with a nod. Although Arcanium couldn't tell me much about the demon in question, they've identified the ice as the result of an ancient spell called Ice Age, one of the great apocalypse magics that only overlords have command over. As the ominous name implied, the great apocalypse magics were incantations to bring about unparalleled destruction. Spells that could literally wipe out entire cities with a single blast, so complex and convoluted that no mortal could ever hope to use them. Not because it was impossible to learn magic not inherent to one's job, though. It was possible to learn spells through years of practice and study, but the great apocalypse magics were in a league of their own. Any attempts to replicate them by mortal minds had resulted in failure or madness. The only reason that Arcanium knew anything about them, including the method to dispel Leosolra's Ice Age, was due to the sealed records detailing past instances where overlords had been unleashed upon a battlefield. That, and they had a few warlocks with level 10 demonology on staff.
Well, that answers the how of things, Edward noted, but not the why. I really can't see a reason why an elven spy would sacrifice his life for something like this.
Oh, the summoner most definitely survived, Question said confidently, completely derailing Edward's train of thought.
He did?
There's no sign of a body anywhere on or near the rooftop, the analyst explained. Or, at the very least, not a mortal one. The scouts did report two hollow ice statues, though. They both had horns and were mostly humanoid in appearance, except that one was well over 2 meters high and the other had wings and rather outrageous curves. They were undoubtedly left behind by the demon's master Shinji told me about.
So the warlock's familiars got caught up in the overlord's rampage, but the actual warlock is nowhere to be seen. Meaning he and that stupid box are probably already across the border, aren't they?
Yep,
the blonde man nodded.
And we have no way of tracking them.
Nope.
Any other witnesses we can probe for information?
Not really. Well, there was this one girl, actually. Aelia Prinny, an elven enchanter and scribe at the local craftsmen's union.
Another elf? Why didn't you mention her sooner?
Because she's squeaky clean, Question shrugged. The Union's guild building was outside of the Ice Age's area of effect, so we were able to confirm that she and her family have been loyal Imperial citizens for 4 generations. We wouldn't have even bothered with her if we hadn't found out that she had contact with the young Underwood.
What type of contact?
The intimate and rigorous kind. I believe the word legendary was brought up at least once.
The afternoon with Chester had been so intense that the elf in question hadn't been able to help blabbing about her tryst, despite the tragedy that had befallen her town. Which was how the Gilded Hand had caught wind of their interaction in the first place, though the investigation had ultimately proved to be a dead end. Most of her co-workers had corroborated her story, claiming that she was rather notorious for having flings with customers, especially if they happened to be younger. Such relations were not against guild policy so long as both parties were above the legal age of 15, which was why Aelia had allowed herself to be so vocal about her latest escapade.
Sounds like our suspect did everything he could to show off, huh?
Edward cupped his chin and thought. The insultingly obvious trail, the conspicuous attack on the city, and the way the elves normally did things all pointed to a single conclusion.
So, this whole incident was to send a message, wasn't it?
Yep.
The contents of which were quite clear. If the Empire officially declared war on the Republic, then its Foreign Intelligence Bureau would retaliate. with terrible consequences.
Those fucking twigs, Edward growled. They really think they can get away with this?
The spymaster took a few moments to calm himself. Though his pride had been injured, responding to the obvious provocation with knee-jerk anger was precisely what his enemies wanted. Decades of experience had taught him time and again that developments such as these needed to be handled with as little emotion as possible. It was partly why he was so fond of the female aide who had been quietly listening to the conversation this entire time.
Zone.
Requesting orders, sir,
she responded in her usual flat monotone.
Send word to our agents across the border, he commanded, his voice level and authoritative. Tell them to keep a close eye on the Republic's dungeons and make sure that nobody brings out anything suspicious. And that goes double for the dungeons in our own territory. I want to be notified the instant someone even so much as sees a dungeon core.
Understood.
Question. Give me projections for any targets that the enemy might decide to hit. I also want a threat assessment as to whether they can launch an attack on the capital.
So, we're still going ahead with this war thing? Question asked.
Of course we are. You think those Underwood bastards are just going to let bygones be bygones? We have to hit them before they can get a chance to use that calamity against us. Actually, where's Mist?
I think he's out back helping Arcanium with the thawing.
The spymaster had left the room, slamming the door behind him before Question could even finish his sentence.
Crazy old bastard has no chill, he mumbled under his breath.
Requesting a moment of your time, Question.
Hmm? What is it, Zone? Finally fallen for my natural good looks, superior intellect, and charming attitude? He grinned. It's okay if you want to leap into my arms and embrace me at any time.
Wanna die?
The icy bloodlust in those two simple words caused the analyst to break out in cold sweat. He sometimes forgot that the spymaster was hardly the only one with a deficit in the chill department.
No, I'm good. So, what do you need?
Have you considered the likelihood that this elf and our mimic are one and the same?
Of course I have, the blonde man scoffed.
And?
And what? It's impossible.
Completely, absolutely, 100% impossible?
This is unlike you, Zone.
Insisting that you answer the question, it's all you're good for anyway.
He sighed.
Well, no. It's theoretically possible if the monster managed to obtain the essence concealment skill. Nothing else could possibly fool an appraisal. Even if the guy in the guild was in cahoots with them, the gate guard definitely would have noticed. But I don't know of any god that would be crazy enough to make that creature into its hero.
What if there was one?
Even if that miracle were to somehow happen, essence concealment can only make one appear weaker, not stronger. Meaning that if the mimic was indeed the elf in disguise, then it would have had to find a way to reclaim its warlock job and raise it back up to level 25, and train its related skills to that high a degree, and rank up into a species capable of disguising itself so completely.
He gave an exaggerated shrug.
I just don't see a way anything could accomplish all that in under a month, especially considering the average monster level on that mountain. I mean, the reports even said that our elf had a personal steel golem of an insanely high quality and was carrying a sizable sum of money in addition to a high-class staff. Where would a box find the opportunity, not to mention the resources, to obtain such things?
Question finished his explanation with another sigh.
Honestly, the odds that this Chester Underwood and Boxy T. Morningwood are one and the same are so astronomically low that they might as well be negative.
I see,
Zone replied after a brief pause.
Expressing gratitude for your cooperation.
She gave the analyst a small nod and calmly stepped out of the room. She proceeded along the hallway and headed down the steps towards the first floor. But there was something different about her. The corners of her mouth were turned ever so slightly upwards, an actual smile on her normally emotionless, doll-like face. She tightened her grip around the piece of torn parchment under her cloak. She had found it yesterday, assuming it to be just another soggy piece of litter, but it had turned out to be some sort of letter or message. And, although the ink had smudged a bit due to the water damage, the contents of the exceptionally silky parchment were still largely legible. Zone's first thought had been to hand it over to her colleagues for analysis, and under normal circumstances she would have done so. But these were not, in fact, normal circumstances. Not when she had seen that the first two words of the message were, "Dear Boxy." You have been listening to Vortina, Everybody Loves Large Chests, Volume 3. Written by Neven Ilyev. Narrated by Jeff Hayes. Proofing and editing by Dalton Lynn. Editing and mastering by Griffin Malnar. Sound design by Jeff Hayes, using sounds from soundsnap.com. Text copyright 2018 by Neven Ilyev. This recording, production copyright 2018 by Neven Ilyev, was produced by Sound Booth Theater in cooperation with Spoken Realms. On the web at SpokenRealms.com. To stay up to date on our productions, or to watch us perform live, sign up for our newsletter at SoundBoothTheater.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.